I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Did you hear me taking a piss?
No, thankfully. I could hear
you. Whatever. You would listen to my stream once and put it into your mental Rolodex for later on. I know you.
I'm just going to
put it. It's always you. It's always you little unassuming. Unassuming little white guys who are into the creepiest stuff. You probably have to like step on a cat to finish or like something strange.
What?
No? Am I wrong?
I have no problems with any of that. I remember when I was in college, I had this buddy who was kind of like freshman year. He was like the music guy. We really bonded over music and like we could never get him to go out in college because he couldn't piss in public.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
He's like, could never take him to a club. Needless to say, our friendship lasted,
hard thing.
But not
a bummer.
Yeah. We didn't hang out much after.
I mean, that's funny in a way. Actually, it's kind of sad. I thought you had a great sexually explicit story for me. So can I tell you about something I discovered?
I can give you a sexually explicit story if you'd like.
Oh, okay. I'll be quiet. Go on.
Now tell me what you discovered.
Okay. I discovered that, and it's something I'm enjoying. Like, there's not much to enjoy about 2020. Well, actually there is if you, you know, decide to look in the right direction. But one thing that's developed apparently is an obsession with your nussy, okay, which is your nose pussy.
What?
And this is what people are calling it online, your nussy. And apparently people are sexually fetishizing getting COVID tests. So they call it your nussy.
Wait.
And they're saying that after like a number of times of getting a COVID test, that feeling you get back there kind of is like a unique feeling that you sort of start to crave.
What?
And people are making these AMSR videos of like, you know, really like soft speaking doctors, like about to like put this thing in your nose. And it's become fetishized. And this is why I love people. Like, people are the greatest. Like, I love people. Oh, humans are the worst. No, we are the best. Because amidst this, we managed to sexually fetishize COVID tests in your nussy. Oh, and I don't know. I couldn't love it more. I couldn't.
This is the first I've heard about this, but it does totally explain something, which I found terribly confusing. I've had two tests, right? Uh-huh. I had an antibody test too, which was a blood test, but I've had two COVID tests where they invaded my nussy.
Yeah.
And the first one was, it was surprising and shocking and not that pleasant. The second one was horrible.
Oh,
the second
okay.
one was like she was digging for a fucking, trying to pop a zit back there or something.
Yeah. Okay.
And I couldn't figure out why there was such a huge difference. Like, was it just the doctor? Had they learned in the interim that like they weren't getting enough like good results? And now I think she was just trying to dissuade me from like getting into it.
Oh, or big or. Maybe she was an S&M type. You know, I'm not like a nurse could be into sadomasochism. Maybe she just enjoyed making you squeal a little bit. Maybe she's on those websites too.
Okay. You reminded me. I'm going to tell you a sex story now.
Oh, okay. Please.
When I was, you know, young and cool and in a band in the Goops. Uh-huh. It was before we had gotten huge, but we were really big in New York.
Okay.
And I needed to go to the dentist. So my friend said, go to my dentist. You're going to really like her. And so I go to his dentist. It was this kind of older, middle-aged woman, but like good shape, right? Like okay. She's a good looking woman.
She's fit.
But she was such a genius because she had literally what I would describe as Playboy material assistant.
Oh, okay.
Like for real, like smoking, like it was like a skit, you know, tight outfit.
Okay.
And she's the one that, you know, cleans your teeth and everything. And I'm to this day, I don't know if this was my imagination, but I swore that while she was digging in, cleaning my teeth, that I could hear her like making noises, like moaning.
Oh, like whispering a little bit?
Like moaning.
Whoa,
and,
really?
And as soon as, and there was, but she was completely professional. There was no indication that this was happening whatsoever.
Yeah, right.
And when it was over, like she was, everything was completely normal. And I was like, am I insane? Like right. I was not desperate at the time. Like I was doing all right. So it wasn't like I'm sitting there imagining that this chick is hot for me or whatever.
Were you on moon gas?
No, she was just cleaning my teeth. But dude, so after it was over, I was like, I was a little bit like flabbergasted.
Yeah, sure.
But I had to give, I had a flyer for a show because we fucking had a show coming up that week.
You gave her a flyer.
And I'm like, hey, can you want to come to my show? Like I'm in a band.
Put you on the guest list.
Never heard from her again. I never went back to that dentist for whatever reason, but to this day, I still think about that experience and think, was I imagining it?
Yeah. Could you perhaps lustily breathe in my ear while I play guitar tonight, young woman? So, all right. So after all these years, like, what do you think was actually happening? Do you think she was actually doing it?
I have no idea. I really have no idea. I mean, obviously, when you get in there with those drills, like, it could make all kinds of resonant frequencies in my jaw. And I could, right. I could imagine hearing anything. And if it had been, you know, like, earlier, if I'd been a teenager or a little more desperate, I could see like making myself believe that that's what was happening. But I was like doing okay at that moment in time. And like, I mean, I would have asked her to come to the show regardless of whether I had thought that that was happening.
You were feeling bold in those
days. So honestly, to this day, I could not tell you. I think that, I don't know. It was an amazing, but the one thing I took away from it was that like, what a genius move to hire this like, super hot dental assistant who like every young rock. I mean, who's the hardest people to get to come to the dentist is like young men, right?
Like, yeah, I suppose so. Oh my goodness. I mean, but then I think, and I'm like, I'm imagining some young woman who happens to be very beautiful, but by like sophomore year of high school, she just has like an obsession with teeth.
Yeah.
You know, and she's just like, oh, I really love the dental world. And what? I wish I didn't look like this so people would take me more seriously in my craft.
Right.
You know?
But also, like, dude, we've also ran into, like, in our time, some pretty nutty women who it's quite possible she was either just trying to fuck with me or maybe she was really into it to that.
We're enjoying extent. It. Yeah. Yeah. It's very possible. So all this being, this is the perfect segue into something I wanted to make sure I talked. And don't feel ashamed, Brad. In another time, I'll tell you the story of when I'm pretty sure I got a blowjob from a ghost. Okay.
Whoa.
But yeah. Another podcast. Okay. But this leads to, you know, last episode, I sort of reached out to the going off track fan base here and I asked for sexually explicit comments on our iTunes message board. And you know how many we got?
I haven't looked. No.
Goose egg, Brad. Not one. I've been checking every day all week to see if somebody would come in hot with a Teddy Pendergrass comment.
Jesus.
Nothing yet.
Maybe
so,
better that we want to get authentic, real, like sincere comments.
Listen, Brad. Every asshole and their mother has a podcast these days, okay? I want to be the one with just unusual and unnecessary sexually explicit comments. It's just funny, isn't it? I don't know. It's funny to me.
It is.
It's funny to me.
It's funny.
Well, as usual, that's 10 minutes not talking about Jeff Rickley or Thursday or the interview we have. But I met Jeff when I was in my, you know, maybe like mid-20s. when I was doing the band, like towards the early 20s, I guess, towards the end of Low End Theory, and then into a band called The Killing Gift, and we started playing shows. And, you know, there was this sequence for a while in New Brunswick where I was watching these bands who my band was bigger than. We'd play a show together. We'd become friends. We'd start to build this community. And then this band would get signed, and then they would leave New Brunswick and I would stay. Thursday was part of that. Luckily, by the time Thursday did it, I'd kind of gotten over it from Midtown and Saves the Day. And I started just being happy for my friends who made it out of town.
Right.
But they were, you know, I mentioned it in this interview. They were one of those bands. It wasn't like Thursday had something cool from the get, you know, but it took them a little while to like really get this like thing that was special. And like what Jeff talked about right there, there was like a quick turnaround where people were like, oh shit, this band is like special, right? You know, and they're doing something interesting and this music is different. You know what I mean? And it's true. There wasn't a lot of bands doing exactly what Thursday were doing at the time. They came out, they had kind of like a great demo and were like killing in the basement shows, a good live performance. And then you just watched it take off. And it was a really fun thing to watch because I was always like proud of Thursday, especially, you know, Jeff and the guys, they were really, they held on to that New Brunswick thing, you know, as long as they could, as big as they got. You'd always see these little signs that like they were still involved or interested in their community and, you know, always wanted to help. And, you know, Jeff talks about in this interview, the struggle of how hard it is to remain like personal and cool like that with everyone when there's too many people. You know, like when you're playing basement shows with eight people there, it's easy to, you know, have a drink with everyone after and you all talk your stories and have this personal connection. But if 1,000 people come to your show and 75 are waiting backstage and 60 of them have a super personal emotional admission that they want to give you, it's taxing on people, man. Like, yeah. And it's probably not even really realistic. No. So it's definitely an interesting part of this interview to talk about because Jeff is such a giving guy in that way. And to even hear him be like, yo, like you just hit a point, like how much of other people's shit can you really take on? You know, like it's impossible at a certain point, but I don't know. He's always a great conversation. Smart guy.
Yeah.
Number 4 on Going Off Track. So, yeah. He's up there amongst the Hall of Famers. I do think if you get a half dozen episodes, you should probably get a coat, right?
I like to refer to these repeaters as, you know, family, Going Off Track family, right?
Are you sending them fucking Christmas presents, Brad?
Hey, maybe.
All right. Well, let's listen to our interview with Jeff.
Hi.
Jeff.
Hi.
Brad was yelling at me.
Brad, what are you doing? What are you doing?
It was 4:27. He's like, get on. Jeff beat us both.
This is what Benny texted to me right there, that message. You see it at the bottom?
Yeah. I'm knit late yet.
Yeah, and he's knit late.
I wasn't knit late yet, man. Jesus. You believe this guy, Jeff?
I believe it is a testament. I think it's a real testament to the quality of our guests that they almost always beat us to the sessions. At least
it's true.
Quality.
It is true. Quality people who are taking our endeavors seriously, yeah. Brad. You know, we couldn't appreciate it more. So, Jeff, thank you for your punctuality. So, what if I did this all in an accent today?
I like it. I think you should. I really like accents.
So, I did go. You know, I went holiday shopping the other day, and one part about mask wearing culture I've been sort of enjoying is kind of like, I like the anonymity, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And there's been a number of times in public settings and stores that I just like will start making a series of funny faces or something under the mask to make myself laugh. But then the other day, I was just feeling a little sprightly in the morning. And the first store I went into, I was just like, hello, yes, I am looking for this. And then I just kept it going. So I wound up doing like 3 or 4 accents through a number of stores. And I don't think I would have had the stones to do it if I wasn't wearing this mask, you know?
Oh, yeah, definitely. because they can see from the shape of your mouth if it's a real accent or a fake accent.
That's right.
That's science. And,
yeah, exactly. And my tiny little beady eyes give nothing away. I'm literally nicknamed Mole Eyes by my wife's family because they can never see my eyes in pictures. So hi, Jeff. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, buddy. How you doing?
I'm young, pretty good.
Young Benjamin.
Young Benjamin. That's my name today. We're old now, Jeff. We met when we were pretty young.
Yeah. We were young when we met, yeah.
20s?
Early 20s.
Early 20s. So this is your third time on Going Off Track.
Is it really?
Yeah, you might be up there amongst the most featured guests. You were on in 2017, and you were also episode number 28 all the way back in 2012. Yeah. Look at that.
Yes. Wait, what about, does this count live? Does this count live Going Off Track?
Sure. Did you do a live one too?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, so you have four. Brad, four. Who beats four? Does anyone beat four?
Somebody's got to be four.
Maybe Rosenstock.
Yeah, I should look up Rosenstock because he's got a lot.
Yeah, he's been up there. I beat four until I hijacked the show.
I just interviewed Jeff Rosenstock for a different thing.
Oh, really?
And he's great. He's a great interview. You only have to ask like one question and he'll just sort of take it in different directions, which I love.
Yeah, he's got an infectious and energetic mind.
Absolutely.
And, you know, luckily I get to play music with him in the Antarctica Vespucci. So I've gotten to see the way that mind moves over to music too. And it's all very similar. It's really, yeah, it's like, it's fast. It's a little messy, but it's always moving forward and it always gets done. You know what I mean? It's like this really like, it's like a tornado that always reaches the finish line. And he's really like an inspiring guy to like work with and be around. It's interesting.
Six episodes.
Oh.
All right. Oh, way beat. Not even close.
Yeah, we got to get him like a golden jacket. Yeah.
But you know what's funny that I didn't remember? We did the first one that we did with him was with Chris Farron, the two of them together. And then he did
the tag team.
Yeah, he did one with Laura and then two more. Yeah, dude, he's like,
what did you interview him for, Jeff?
Uprox. Do you know Uprox?
I do, yeah.
Like a video thing.
About anything specific or just like rapping?
Making a mixtape. It's my show.
Oh yeah, that's your new program. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's my lockdown interview show.
Yeah. So what's been the vibe? I'm sorry, I haven't listened yet. So
you haven't watched it yet? You haven't watched our beautiful faces in lockdown?
I'm sorry, I haven't.
It's done with studio magic to bring us together across the lockdown.
And then you do what? You go song for song and make a mixtape?
Yeah, we go through and pick some music together and talk about it.
I love it. Do you try to keep it like thematic in the way that you would make an actual mixtape?
Yes. So each episode with a different guest has its own like its own theme. Mm-hmm. And I say that theme in every segment as many times as possible.
Okay.
So I just will be like, you know, over and over again, like this is the energy mixtape. You know, I try and emphasize it a certain way.
Yeah. Now, what are like, what are your like Rob Gordon mixtape rules?
Uh huh.
Do you have any hardcore like cannot break these mixtape rules?
I try to listen to each song before I put it on the mix. I like to have heard it at least once before I put it on the mixtape.
Okay.
I try not to put any songs that I'm like, yeah, put it on there. I've never heard it.
Okay. That's not too tough. Okay.
But I had to negotiate that to get it in my contract.
But what about What about flow? Like you like opening and closing a certain way?
No.
You know,
I'm a mixtape anarchist. Like I'm like, let's try it. Whatever. I don't care. Let's go.
Man, I used to think about it so much when I was on cassette. I was like, this next song dictates whether this woman will fall in love with me or not.
Totally. And I think that's why now I'm an anarchist is because I have somebody who, for whatever reason, seems to love me unconditionally. So I'm just always testing the limits. Like, what if I put this crazy song on the mixtape next?
I love that. I love that. Yeah. I know you're a big reader. So mm-hmm. I'd like you to listen. I've become a bit of an anarchist with reading. Ooh. And I've said this to a couple people who really took great umbrage to what I said.
Yeah.
Which is at this point, at this stage, I turned 40 this year. You know, I'm not fucking around anymore. Windows
Congrats,
closing.
Join the club.
You
know? I love
Thank
it.
You. Thank you. And now that life is a closing window rather than an open road. When I get into a book, you know, sometimes you're 50, 60 pages in a book and you're just like, you know what? It's just not going to do it for me. Mm. I can see it the way it's written, the way these characters are developing. Mm. Even if there's a twist, I'm not going to enjoy this. Wow. And if I'm getting that sense from a book, I go, you know what? Fuck it. I flip to the last 10 pages. I see what happens and I move on with my life.
Oh, wow.
How do you feel about that?
Yeah, no, I take extreme umbrage with it. Extreme. Because my partner, she's a bit of an anarchist when it comes to it too. She'll okay. decide around 100 pages whether or not she's going with it.
Love it.
And she'll just stop. She'll just stop. But she won't even, she's not the kind of person to flip to the end and just be like, oh, now I know what happened.
She's just out.
She respects that, like, I'm not going to know. I don't care.
Oh, okay.
The flip to the end, Benny, is something that I think you need to look into because that's twisted.
I respect it, but I think it's one of the craziest things I've ever heard in my
oh
life.
Oh, my God. Tell me why, though. Why is it twisted?
Because you're like, you're trashing the book and saying, I'm never going to read this ever.
That's it. That's it. It's a commitment to, like, you know what? Screw this book. Now I know what happened and I have no respect for how you got there.
Yo, but come on. There's a lot of books. You know, there's a lot of people like mm-hmm. I'm not going to put out an album, right? And expect every person who's going to listen to this album to sit down, go track 1 through 11, reading lyrics, looking at art and going for the whole experience. You know, I know there are going to be some people who are going to be like, yeah, this track's good. And they're never going to hear the other ones or something. Like you can't be.
But you know
that
whole thing about spoiler,
like that, right?
You know that thing about like spoiler warnings, though?
Yeah.
It's like that. It's like, you're just like, it's like if I played you the first song of my new album, right?
Right.
And you were like, I'm going to commit right now to never listening to this record based on this first song. Like, I actually, you know what? I'm going to tell everybody else about how bad this record is right now. That's what it feels like when you skip to the end. Cause it's like, there's no way you're going back after that.
Yeah. But like, but let's say this, right? Let's say you just turn on Metallica's, Saint Anger.
Okay.
Right. And you hear that snare drum and you're just like, oh God, no, 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 no. I can't do 40 minutes of that. That's fair, isn't it?
That's fair. Well, with that record, it's definitely fair. Did you ever know about our game in Thursday? Did we ever play this with you guys? I can't remember.
I'm not sure.
We have a game in the Thursday van back in the days of the van it's called Stanger.
Okay, go on.
And the game is that whoever you're traveling with by van, if you can throw a CD copy of Saint Anger out of your window and into their van, they have to listen to it front to back. That's getting stangered. If it lands in your van, you got stangered and that's it. You have to listen to it. Yeah.
How many successful stangers did you pull off?
So many.
Wait, why did you have that many copies of their album around?
No, because they'd get us back.
Oh, I see.
So like, you know who really hated this game because he lost so many times is Brandon from Circa.
Circa.
When he was in what was the band?
This Day Forward.
This Day Forward. When he was in This Day Forward, man, we got them so many times.
They're pretty mellow dudes. I could see it.
They're so mellow and they're so cool. So they would never listen to a record like that. They actually smashed it on the road once, smashed it out of anger without even trying to get us back. We went and bought another copy at like $18.99 back when CDs were worth something.
That is commitment.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
It was worth it.
I mean, this makes sense. I did hear in another article that you were named after Chaucer and Shakespeare. I never realized that about you.
Oh, me. Yeah, personally, right. I was. Yeah.
Yeah. So I can understand.
Geoffrey Chaucer and William Shakespeare. That's where my mom got my names.
So yeah, where did that come from? Like
for her, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Like what was the push to do that? Was she trying to create a novelist or?
Well, she was a scholar. She has a PhD in 18th century comparative literature, I think.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure that's it. I think it's comparative lit. I'm not sure if that's the actual title. But like illuminated manuscripts and stuff like that. And I think, yeah, she just really, she was putting all her, her faith in me being a writer, I think. And instead I went this way.
does she teach or does she write?
She did a little bit of teaching. I was born in Providence because my parents met at Brown University.
Okay.
And they did some teaching, you know, to pay for like graduate school and whatnot.
Got you.
But no, she ended up taking a big like marketing job after that.
Gotcha.
She hated it. She hated basically her entire career after teaching.
Just because she had to go corporate kind of?
Yeah. Well, also like, yeah, just, I guess at the time in the '80s in like the suburbs, she had a lot of bosses that didn't respect her cause she was a woman.
Sure. Yeah.
And they were all like, you know, they were all much stupider than she was. And so right. She had to constantly get crap from guys who didn't know what they were talking about.
That is some horribly frustrating shit.
Yeah.
How was it met for you, like coming from academics to, mm-hmm. you know, obviously you went to school. I mean, that's where I met you and where Thursday began and all that. But
right.
you obviously made a turn to deny any more academic activities. And
well, you know, we all dropped out before we graduated.
Right.
So, yeah.
So how was that like received when you all decided to, because all the other guys were in art school, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So how was that received by your folks when you took that pivot?
They were pretty good about it, to be honest. And I think it started like the kind of like, it started before they wanted me to go to Brown and be like a legacy. They're like, you know, we could probably get you in there like for nothing because you're, you know, the next in line and they love that stuff, especially right. since we met here, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, no, I want to go to state school. You know, I want to go to Rutgers. I just want to, you know. I've got other stuff that I want to do that has nothing to do with what you guys want for me. So I think right. that's kind of when I fought that battle a little bit with them. And then by the time I quote unquote took a year off to do touring,
right.
they were like, sure, have fun for a year. And then it was kind of like, it started working out, you know, and
yeah.
they were like pretty excited for me.
How much of that year to you was open-ended or did you actually just make your mind and say it was a year?
It was, so for like the first 6 months after Full Collapse came out, like nobody cared at all, at all.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, if anything, we went from playing basements to like 30 people to like, now we're going to 10, you know, now we're going to 7 people. Now there's like 2 people in a kitchen. Right. So it was pretty, it was looking pretty much like everybody was like, well, we're going to have to do something else. You know what I mean? Like this is certainly right. like, this has been great sort of. You know,
yeah, like maybe, it's been all right, guys. Yeah.
Maybe not. Yeah. But, you know, and then it was like a weird, like right at the buzzer, basically like right before the year was up, we took a tour with Saves the Day. And it just sort of changed everything where by the end of the tour, we were getting like the crowd was asking for encores from us and stuff where it was just, you know what I mean? It was like shocking. Like we went from nothing happening to like all of a sudden we started catching on, which was great and
weird.
Yeah,
yeah. And there you are. You're not at Brown wearing an ascot and smoking a pipe.
No.
Sitting at a cafe working on your fifth novel. If you were a novelist, what would you be writing? What kind of stuff?
Probably if I had started back then, it undoubtedly would have been like postmodernism stuff. That's what I fell in love with in school, you know, like when I read White Noise and Underworld and like just kind of like the Don DeLillo's of the world and stuff like that. It really like, it really did something to me and I got really into that kind of stuff.
What are your favorite kinds of books these days?
I mean, I still like Don DeLillo. I read his new one, but I really, I kind of read everything that anyone recommends to me. I'll just go for it. But
yeah,
I just read a really great book that I thought was going to be like my holiday book that would stretch me through because it was a long one, but it was so good that I finished it in like a week. It's called A Naked Singularity and great is name. Written. Yeah, it's a great, great name, and is written from the point of view of a public defender in the New York carceral system.
Interesting.
And how horrifying it is to watch, you know, like 60-year-old Chinese men get picked up for selling batteries on the train and not have the bail to get out, so spend like 30 to 60 days awaiting trial for, you know, for selling batteries on the train.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, and like getting beat up in jail, you know, all these things. It's like, oh, if he had like, you know, whatever, a few hundred dollars on him, he would have come back and gotten a slap on the wrist. But now he's like been in jail and gotten beat up and all this stuff, you know, just that kind of stuff. It's really upsetting. And it was so specific that afterwards I had to look it up, and it looked like he did have, you know, a former career as a public defender.
So it was like fiction, not so much.
Yeah, it was like fiction, but like, you know, I'll change some names, and these are all stories that I actually saw happen.
Yeah, those are the worst kinds. I'm going through that right now with a Richard Powers book.
I love Richard Powers.
Yeah, one of my favorites. So I'm reading the new one. Was it called The Overstory?
That's, I think that's one of the best books I've read in the last 5 years.
Yeah. So you've read it. I think three chapters into this book, and each chapter has just ripped my fucking heart out.
Yeah.
And you know, my whole way of reading books is like, I like to have a fiction and a nonfiction unfold at the same time. And based on my mood and how I'm feeling is if I can stomach the nonfiction or the fiction, or, you know, and this one was supposed to be my fun fiction, and it's up my whole flow. 'Cause the stories, like the book you were just talking about, you know, the stories are so rooted in an actual reality where it's so real. And, you know, watching the environmental thing play out, it's just a little too real. I think I'm going to try to find like the Anchorman manuscript or something like that to balance it out, you know?
I'll tell you what, though, don't give up on that one, because when it finished, I gave it to my partner and she read it. And now we go to parks and like look up which trees are which, and we touch them and talk to them, and like, you know what I mean? We've really become like literal tree huggers since then. She has an app that'll tell you what each tree is on the streets of New York City. So she'll walk by and she'll be like, that one's a London plane tree. That one's a this kind of tree.
I need that. Yeah. So Jeff, I just moved to the woods. So this is all extremely apropos right now.
Yes.
The woods, i.e. the suburbs with trees.
Hey, listen, Lower East Side.
Dude, that sounds incredible.
You've been
right
in
now.
New York so long, you can't talk shit anymore.
I'm jealous.
Okay. The little 12-year-old kid from Maine who is skipping chestnuts in the frozen lake. All right. He doesn't exist anymore, Brad. All right. You're just a hip city dad now.
I'm jealous. I want a basement.
With rich, famous people who go to your kid's school.
So, Brad, when you like pull over on the side of the road and see the median, you're like, look at all that countryside, rolling hills of countryside.
Dude, I was back in the day when I used to ride motorcycles. I remember I went up the Taconic Parkway and got got about 45 minutes outside of the city, and there's a state trooper pulled over in the median, you know, like where it's about maybe, I don't know, 50 feet wide, like, just shaking his head at this entire family of, let's call them downtown New Yorkers, Lower East Side New Yorkers, who had basically got in their minivan and got that far and saw that patch of grass and was like, this is a great place for a picnic. That exact thing I witnessed. Your joke was my reality.
That's real. I've done that on tour. Have you ever done that on tour, Jeff, where you've been on like such a long trip and it sucks so bad and like you stop? There's been a couple times I've rolled out of a van or a bus and found a warm green patch of grass and just laid in it. Like immediately after leaving. Yeah. It was like, it's like when you're, you know, stricken at sea and you find land, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I've done that. We definitely did that when we would like go through Texas and finally see grass again when we got out the other side, you know, be like, oh, grass, thank you. You know, like it's not arid desert that like if we stop here, we're probably all going to die.
Yeah, right.
It sometimes feels that way because Texas is so much bigger than you even realize when you look at a map. Right.
It's terrifying. You know? When you hit that part in, was it all the way in East Texas when you enter And the sign says like El Paso, 940 miles.
Right.
Or something like that. It's like, wait, what?
You're like, it's seriously like 13 hours from now?
That's like what Europe. That's Europe.
Yeah. We just crossed all of it. Yeah, see ya.
Exactly. Europe. So before we get too far away from the poetry thing, not poetry or just the literature thing, like,
sure.
You know, I hadn't really conceived it at the time, probably because I was just, you know, more young and lunkheaded. But, you know, when I see, you know, Thursday lyrics and some of the presentation, I see a little more of a literary feel and a kind of poetic feel to it now that I didn't really notice when I was younger. Was that something you were like intentionally doing, and were you intentionally trying to like put that into the kind of hardcore archetype?
Well, you're opening a real can of worms here, Benny.
I like worms.
Yeah, actually, I very much, yeah, worms are so delicious. yeah, no, it is very conscious. It was actually my honors thesis. So like we dropped out of college, but like in the last semester. So I had already done my honors thesis and
wow.
stuff like that.
Holy shit.
And it was about narrative techniques in lyrics being like approached from a postmodern point of view.
Oh, wow.
So it was very intentional. And like my thesis itself actually turned into what the lyrics to Full Collapse were.
No shit.
Yeah. So actually, so my advisor, my thesis advisor is a somewhat famous poet who just passed away just 2 weeks ago.
Oh, wow.
Miguel Algerin. He's a brilliant man. He started the New Yorican Poets Cafe, and he was like a part of a lot of, you know, young writers' journeys. And I really like feel like I owe a lot to him and the way he made me think about, you know, what it meant to write and what it meant to try and express yourself and stuff like that. So yeah, it was very intentional that I was trying to do a bunch of stuff with Thursday lyrics in the early days.
Yeah. And then you were putting it into like heavy music. Was that also a thing you were trying to do? Like, can I actually mix these two things and make it actually happen?
You know, I wasn't super self-conscious about the heavy music part of it.
Okay.
I always thought that, that the hardcore scene that we came from was kind of like, you can do anything here. That's one of the things that like when we would go to shows and it would be like Rain or Maria and Converge, right. Like to me that meant like, you can do whatever you want. Yeah, it's not, there's no rules here. Like there's no, like, you know, it doesn't have to be a purist kind of thing was always something that I inherently believed in. And I think that like being from New Brunswick and those basement shows that we were all a part of, that was like a big reason why I thought like hardcore is this other thing. It's about the community. It has nothing to do with whether you're heavy or you can mosh to it or not. It doesn't matter.
Sure. Wasn't it amazing?
Maybe naively.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I had that same realization kind of getting out of New Brunswick, where I didn't realize till I left how kind of special what was happening was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I kind of in my head thought every city everywhere had this thing going on. You
right.
know, like a collection of people and basements and bands. And like you said, for the most part, you know, there were things here and there, but for the most part, super supportive, bands being supportive of each other. And I don't know if you could call it promoters. It was usually guy in band like me or you or something, you know, doing.
There were a couple gems who like didn't play in bands, but still wanted to do shows.
Well, you had one in your house, right? You had the almighty Clay Weirs.
Yeah.
Clay. You could do a podcast on Clay in itself. I don't even know where that guy is these days. I think he's in the Middle East.
Right.
Yeah.
I was going to say, if you know, you're not allowed to talk about
it
is the rule.
I don't care anymore because I don't think it matters, but I literally got, you know, he lived in my house. Wait, he lived in your house too. Did you get a call?
Yeah.
You did. Yeah, I did too.
I did. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So we both, wow. Well, it's good to know the government actually does something, right? Huh?
I know, right? Some background checks. But although like, I feel like if they talk to me and listen to what I said, they added like four other background calls to it because like I didn't have any thoughts of like what I should or shouldn't say. I was just kind of like, yeah, I mean, yeah, I don't know, he's kind of like reactionary or something. You know what I mean? I would just say like whatever came to my mind.
Like sometimes he gets really angry and sort of screams in a half German accent. Is that cool? Or?
Right. Like whatever. It's like, don't call that guy, you know? Yeah. It's like probably why they called me, is he was probably like, yeah, don't bother with him.
So just for the lack of confusion, if there's people listening who are confused, Jeff and I both lived with a person in different houses who wound up being a part of the federal government. And mm-hmm. we both received calls.
In a sensitive area.
Yeah. That had background checks and whatnot. Yeah, I don't even remember what I said. It was short, though. It was like, did he live there? Yes. I'm like, are you guys actually calling about the weed that's in my house? Because that's what I'm nervous about right now. And you remember that house, Jeff, the crazy house that lived in Highland Park. You showed up there a few times.
Had some good times there.
Yeah, we all did. But all right, so this is what I want to know now.
Mm-hmm.
You wake up, you're how long have you been sober now? A couple years, 3 years?
I just celebrated 3 years. Yeah.
Fuck yeah. That's awesome. Congratulations, first off.
Thank you.
Extremely happy for you.
Thank you. Me too. Life is so much better. It's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I want to talk about it because, you know, it's something I know I myself suffer with and a lot of people who listen do. And I heard you mention that, you know, what you find most important, especially through the pandemic, is having like a sense of routine. And
absolutely.
That the empty space and the empty time are like the times when you could, you know, slip or something like that, or have the feeling like you could slip. I'm sure you're farther away from that now. So what's like take me through a morning. Like, what are you doing? What do you do? I'm coffee, so like, breakfast. I want deets.
Yeah.
Too. Yeah. I want
deets. Yeah. So like I wake up pretty early, you know, 5:30, 6 a.m. every day. And I have a very extremely ritualized, you know, coffee routines, like pour overs. I have like burr grinders and like, I'm really into it. And it's because it's like one of the few drugs that I'm allowed left to have, you know, it's caffeine.
Right.
So like, I'm very into the like ritualized aspect of like, here it comes, you know, like the longer the routine takes, the more I can anticipate that little bit of buzz you get from caffeine.
Sure.
Which, you know, as like, you know, I don't know the different levels of, you know, drinking or whatever, but that either of you are in. But for me, as a hardcore drug addict, the anticipation is super intense. And they've done a lot of like studies on the human brain that actually your brain releases a small amount of the dopamine and serotonin that you get from doing drugs when you think about doing drugs.
Yes.
So like that is a very real hit that you get when you're like preparing.
Sure. So you think you almost like trick your brain when you're doing the coffee thing into kind of having that feeling?
Yeah. Like, and it's like subtle, you know, so it starts to build and I'm like, yes. But I remember like there were times when I'd be in the craziest withdrawal in my life and I'd finally get a hold of my drug dealer and he'd be like, meet me in 15 minutes and the withdrawal would go away.
Yes. Yeah.
It was like, okay.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking. It always makes me think of the end of Requiem for a Dream, which is that really powerful part where Jennifer Connelly, you know, goes ass to ass in front of all those rich guys and gets her hair and she doesn't do it. She just brings it home, lays down on the couch with it. Just knowing it's there is enough, you know?
Right. Yeah. Just having it, the security.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
it's powerful. All right. So you do the as close to drug coffee as you can.
Yeah. So I make that and then I do stretches and stuff. And if it's one of the mornings when I work out, then I work out. Mm-hmm. And the main thing that I'm watching for is there, you know, in Brooklyn here, there's a pretty big contingent of stray cats, and one of the stray cats in the neighborhood is my best friend's stray cat. And she comes like 2-3 times a day to eat.
Okay.
So I watch for her little face at what we call our takeout window.
Aww.
And when she shows up, I like really, you know, I get really excited and I get a can of food and I put, you know, a bunch of treats around it and stuff. And then I go bring it to her. And
what's her name?
Lola.
Lola. Good.
Yeah. She's the best. There's like going to be like 10 people who hear this that are like, oh, we know Lola. She's the best. So
she'll have an Instagram soon.
Yeah, probably. Right. She's definitely like the mom of a bunch of the bodega cats in Greenpoint. But, okay. So anyway, then I'll start, you know, I'll start writing, or I'll start, you know, I'll start one of the, creative endeavors that I'm a part of, whether it's music or I do some pre-production and vocal coaching of younger artists and stuff like that. So I'll take it out and I'll start working on it. I try to get like a lot of the work done before noon. That's like when my mind is at its best.
Okay.
Then around noon, that's when my sponsees start calling me. So I sponsor a couple guys in the program.
Okay. Yeah.
And they'll check in around then, and I'll like kind of catch up with them and see where they're at and try and help them out. And then the afternoon I try and devote a little more to like what I would call like service type things, where it's like maybe I'm doing something around the house, or I'm checking in with somebody else what they need from me, or I'm like, you know, the kind of the work that goes on with my band that's like not the fun part, not the creative part.
Right, right. Oh, like 3:30, time to do a podcast, that kind of vibe?
Yeah, exactly, exactly, you know? Like the stuff that I'm like, oh, I hate this guy. Oh, why do I have to talk to Benny?
Shit.
I wish I was like doing like lots of stuff with people that I didn't like, but you know how it is. Like eventually you're long enough into the band that like, you know, it's mostly the people that like you like that you actually still talk to.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. You kind of got it thinned out by now.
Yeah. The people that I don't like they don't like me. And also like Thursday's not such a huge cultural force now that they have to talk to me.
Oh, right. So they don't have to pretend to like you anymore.
Right. Yeah.
Sounds actually kind of freeing. Like I've gotten to make that delineation the last few years too. You know?
There's a turning point where you're like not on everybody's lips anymore. And like you start to realize like, oh, you didn't like me back
exactly.
then.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, a lot less people checking in, huh? There's no tours to put someone on. I get it.
Yeah, right.
How important, I know, you know, some people in my family, without getting too specific, you know, struggled with mental health and they found an avenue through education. Getting into education and almost taking on other people's problems. Helped bring theirs. Do you find that with actually being a sponsor now, like, are you fueled at all by the ability to like help other people and that allowing you to get out of your own head a little?
Well, I think it's interesting when you say like taking on somebody else's stuff, like that's actually, I think one of the things that being a sponsor is like so good for, because now I also like once a week we'll go to like an Al-Anon meeting and try and realize that like I will totally like push off my own problems by like inhabiting and getting too involved in other people's problems.
Right. Yeah.
My boundaries are like non-existent. So like sponsoring guys, like I've had to work on not letting myself get caught up, you know, because I will. And so that's been good practice for like, you know, all the kinds of relationships that I generally like. If there's like a, you know, a problem in the band where somebody's having a hard time, like getting so emotionally involved with what they're going to do and getting so mad at them if they don't do what I want to do now, where I can just be like, well, you're going to do what you're going to do, man. Like I can tell you what my opinion is, but also like, I don't really know. So, you know, this is my like third party opinion and I know you're going to do what you got to do and I love you no matter what. Yeah. And that's not going to change. But also maybe I won't be able to pick up every call if you don't. You know, if you don't handle this the right way. Yeah, so like, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah. But a little less like life or death when it comes down to it.
Right. Like you're going to do what you're going to do. And I'm going to tell you that like, if you do this thing, like I may not be able to be there for you through it.
Right.
But I love you.
Yeah.
Like a new thing for me.
That's cool. Sounds empowering. I mean, I was going to ask about that because I've seen, you know, there's a difference between the way, you know, a listening audience views a vocalist and views other people in the band. You know, I've seen this delineation and it's not something I get offended by. It's about the lyrics, the person delivering the lyrics, puts a connection in that just doesn't exist otherwise. And I've seen people with Brian from Gaslight, you know, he'll come outside after something and all of a sudden he's two or three stories into like the worst fucking stories I've ever heard. You know what I mean? Like really awful shit that other people are going through. And I was imagining that, and I was imagining with you, it could be like times 10, because you're such an open guy. Your heart and your story has been so far out there, especially with your depression and the addiction, and people have such a deep connection to Thursday. Does that happen to you? Are you often like giving these very heavy tales of other people's pain? And how do you, how can you reconcile that, like, personally?
Well, I do think that our audience has gotten older for the most part, and it's gotten easier because people have worked through some of their stuff and realized boundaries more than they used to. But yeah, there was a time when it was extremely heavy.
Yeah.
And in the early days, I was very much like, you know, I was always trying to figure out what it meant to me to not sell out. And like, one of my big things, you know, was like, look, there shouldn't be any delineation between like bands and audience. It should just be like a community. And that was something I took like very seriously. And I, you know, when I first started getting asked to sign autographs, I had a really hard time with it.
Yeah, me too.
And so what I did was I brought a journal with me and asked people to sign the book, you know, sign my book, write me a note, I'll write you a note, you know,
that's sweet.
We'll stay in touch or whatever.
Yeah, right, right.
And at some point it was like, okay, you know, like at the height of Thursday's career, we're selling out like 3,000 to 5,000 seaters. Yeah. And that's like, you can't do that with that many people.
Who's got time for that? Yeah.
And you can't do that with like a couple hundred people a night either, because like, you know how it is when you're on tour in the middle of being successful, they keep you on tour nonstop.
Right.
You know, you got to make hay while the sun is shining, as they say, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And like, that doesn't last forever. So you try and make the most of it.
That's right.
And like, man, it was getting me down because people were giving me very sincere stories that I wanted to talk to them, and I wanted to like absorb it and have something useful to say, even just to lend like a, lend an ear, you know, just to say, I understand. I don't know what to tell you, but I get it. That, that hurts.
Yeah.
And you can't always, and it started to really get to me.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, because I found myself having to say like, not tonight. I can't talk to anybody because it was so painful.
Yeah. Cause some nights you personally can't take all that on. Right.
Yeah. And then I'm saying, oh shit, like maybe some of these guys that came before me that I thought were rock star assholes, like putting on the sunglasses and walking through the back door. Or just can't do it. It's like too emotionally taxing, and they're not just jerks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think a lot of them probably were. Like the 80s were not that far removed from us. You know? But
well, yeah, I mean, it's tricky because then some people, you know, with you, this is a very honest and real concern and something that weighed on you. But then other people can take the same concern and use it to not talk to anybody. You know what I mean? Like,
I think even I did. You know what I mean? Like sometimes I would just be like, no, tonight I want to go out drinking with my friends. Like, fuck everybody.
Right.
Let them wait in line. You know what I mean? Like, and that's like, so yeah, everybody can take advantage of that. And like, I've been a jerk to fans, like for sure.
Sure. That's one part about being a drummer I love. You know, it really is like, I come out back and people are like, oh, Benny, what's up, man?
Yeah,
and I'm like, yeah, what's
awesome.
Going on? You know, you cool? Like, yeah, what's going on? How are the Kansas City Royals doing? You know? And then, before I know it, I'm fine. And then I'd see like Brian walk out and people are just like, and it's just this whole different feel. And I would look at it and it never made me jealous. Cause I'm like, Jesus Christ, I don't want that. Like I can't handle that.
Yeah. And Brian, like, you know, maybe he wasn't always as like open and direct, but I do think that there's a different thing, which is that there's like sort of a mythology around him that like, hey, he's a person. You know what I mean? Like whatever your romanticizing leads you to think about him, like he's also just a guy that wants to go eat his food after the show.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I kind of eventually, I think the people who liked the band respected sort of the simplicity in the way he wanted to live because it's consistent.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You know, guys that come from where Brian comes from and the experience he had, you know what I mean? That's the way they handle their evening. Like, and you know, if you want authenticity, that's authentic, you know?
Yeah.
All right. So I want to take a little turn here. Brad?
Yeah, Mayor.
Brad, are you queued up? Are you queued up and ready, friend?
I think I'm queued up.
Uh-oh.
Okay. So, Jeff, this is a new segment of the show called Mystery Question.
Oh.
Where we get a friend or enemy of the past, who knows?
Nice.
I'm gonna keep you on your toes. and they submit a question to us via audio. Brad, okay. Drop it on. Come on.
Hey, Jeff, it's Jonah. I hope you're doing well. Benny texted me earlier today asking me to submit a mystery question for you for this podcast. And I was sort of thinking back to how long we've known each other, which is almost 20 years at this point, which is totally wild.
Whoa.
And in the early 2000s, around the time we met, I was in a band called The Love Kill from Cleveland, who you actually signed to your Eyeball Records
yes.
imprint Astromagnetics way before United Nations. So my mystery question for you today is, in 30 seconds, how many bands from the Astromagnetics roster can you name? And Benny, I'd like you to time this. Jeff, this is probably not something you think about very often, so good luck. And yeah, Brad, Benny, Jeff, I hope you're all doing well and take care.
That is so dark, man. Well, he had to put a time limit on it.
Clearly not an enemy.
Man.
Friend of you, friend of the program, the much beloved Jonah Bayer chiming in.
Jonah Bayer's the best.
You tell me, I got my stopwatch up right now. You tell me when you're ready.
I'm so bad with names. I'm so bad with names. This is gonna kill me, man. This is like,
are people gonna be insulted by the end of this?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh,
absolutely.
Good. This is the juicy stuff I want, Jeff. So many people have podcasts, man. I need juice. You know?
Okay.
I need
okay.
juicy okay. meat. All right. Tell me when okay. to start.
Okay. Okay. Start. Go ahead. Start.
Okay. We're gone.
Well, so we got the Love Kills, Jonah, right?
Yeah.
Then probably next easiest for me is the Blackout Pact. Yeah. I produced their record.
Remember
Love
them.
Those guys. Kiss Kiss, because they're uh-huh. absolute friggin' maniacs. The Valley Arena, because I think they're probably my favorite of those bands. Sorry, guys. Secret Lives of the Freemasons were yeah, probably uh-huh, the most uh-huh. popular band out of all those. And there's definitely more.
Three, two, one. We're done.
Bomber.
All right, I'll allow it. All right, okay, that's okay. six. 6 and 30 seconds. That's good, Jeff. Not bad. Not bad at all.
No, it's bad. You know why it's bad?
Why? Who did you forget?
Because it's going to be like, oh, you only forgot one or you only forgot two. You know what I mean? Then it's great. Thanks a lot.
It's going to be the people. I'm sure your fucking mixtape show is doing that already because someone's like, you know what, Jeff? I would have been perfect for that fucking mixtape. Did you forget about us? So that's awesome. But you have this long history of getting into the other side of things. You know, like almost from the get, like you were getting behind the scenes, producing, signing bands, like, you know, and then obviously kind of culminated with, you know, the Collect Records thing and hasn't really, progress since, right? Was that the death
people
of
are
you
always
trying
like,
to do that?
Yeah, people are always like, you're gonna do another label. You're too good at it. You found too many great bands. It's like, dude, you go through what I went through with Collect Records and want to do it again.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you go through a scan. You build up, like, what you think is going to be, like, the best label. Put your heart and soul to it. Don't sleep. Like, run yourself ragged. Like, and then have it, like, collapse in a way where everybody's like, I always knew Jeff was a bad guy. Like I knew he'd be involved with bad people. And you know what I mean? Like having literally the controversy be like, not just a big story, but like literally maybe the biggest story of the year.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And I knew it was the biggest story of the year because I put out a record called a band called No Devotion. It was my band.
Right. Yeah.
And we were leaving for tour. The record was coming out. That was the week that it all happened. That was the week that Martin's controversy happened.
Right.
And I was getting on a plane when it was happening. And when I got off the plane, before I opened my phone to check and see what was happening, I was standing in customs online, you know, where they don't let you take out your phone yet,
right.
German customs.
Yeah, right.
And it was all over the German news.
No. Oh, so you were seeing it on the TV?
And I was like, in Germany, it's a story. Like, oh man. This is so bad, you know?
Now, I didn't follow it too closely, but you met that guy a bunch of times, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, we're closely involved. Like,
we weren't, like, that closely working on the label together, but, like, I knew him. Like, I had dinner and lunch with him, and, like, I had talked to him a bunch of times and, like, and considered him a friend, probably, I guess I would say.
And is it one of those situations where... what happened? Like, did you have any inclination. Like, you've met a lot of people. You've been in, like, you know, you've been in the drug world, you know, not as a seller, but someone who has to, I know how it is, man.
Negotiate.
If you want to do drugs, you got to deal with a bunch of fucking sketchy people. And, you know, so you, it's not like you were green going into this, like a fairly well-seasoned guy. There wasn't any indication to you that something was like afoot? Like, was he that like sociopathic that like, because the great sociopaths are the ones who like have everyone fooled, right?
I don't know, man. I don't know. It's something I've thought about a lot, you know, and I think that. So what I'd say first is my greatest sin that I've made over and over again as a musician is thinking that like I am smart enough or have enough experience that I won't be the one to get fooled constantly, you know, like going into like stuff with Victory, going into stuff with like a major label, going into stuff here, there, the other, like I've always said, well, we're smart guys. Like we won't make that mistake. And then it's like, boom, you make the exact same mistake of being like, they really like us and they're not going to do anything to hurt us. And, but you know, like, you know, that just sort of like not seeing yourself and your own limitations clearly enough, I think, is a repeat. And I'd say with being able to read somebody, like, you know, Martin was very sincere, and he, I do believe that he very much wanted to help a bunch of bands out. He's a fan of music. You know, that's something that's been a butt of a joke many times when talking about him, is like how much, you know, he stands certain bands and stuff. And I do think probably he was sincere about wanting to help all the bands. And also, like, you know, so when somebody's trying to help you out and give you money, you're already prone to see the best in them. And also, like, the kind of later on, like, supervillain persona that people know him by is not something that I saw in my personal interactions with him. And so when I was in, like, boardrooms and stuff with him being like, you should give me $250,000 to give to this band or buy all my band's vans or to, you know, like these crazy ideas that I would have, like, yeah, well, we're going to make contracts where they can take their records and masters back anytime they want if they're not happy. And like trying to convince them that that was like a normal thing that happened in record labels, you know? And he would kind of be very shy and sort of, you know, nerdy, I guess is probably the best way to say it. So
pretty unassuming.
Did you know he was a bad guy? It's like, I don't know, man. Like, I just thought like, how's this guy a CEO? Like, he seems so unsure of certain things, you know, but very smart, very
sure.
You know, he would do projections and calculations in his heads about like how much something would cost year over year with an incredible, like he would just, you know what I mean? He would just say it out loud and I'd hear him going through it and I'd lose track of what he was talking about. Both my parents are very smart people and I just would lose track of his, but I know he was right. I could tell he was like, knew what he was talking about.
Yeah, and,
so, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, did I see signs of him being sociopath? I didn't. Yeah. I didn't see it. And my mom, sometimes when I tell her, I think, you know, I have some great idea, she's like, well, do remember that like a week before things happened with Martin, you told me like, I really think he's one of the good ones. I know he owns a pharmaceutical company, but I think he really cares about people. Like I had said that to my mom like the week before this happened. So like,
and yeah, she calls you out on that, huh?
She loves it. Whenever I have like a bad idea and I'm like, nah, Ma, you don't know what you're talking about. She's like, well,
yeah, but Jeff, you know? You're not
it's
alone,
tough, but I respect it. It's tough.
You're not alone with that, Jeff. I mean, when that thing went down, there was a lot of people, very respectable people who kind of came to his defense in turn, at least, you know,
initially.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, that vouched for sort of his like good nature, you know?
Well, now you're getting at some very like fundamental stuff about what we, you know, what do we know about people, right? Like, are they monsters or do they decide to start going down a bad path and making bad decisions? Or like, you know what I mean? Like, what is it like? And that's something I've debated with people that I'm close to a lot. Like, you know, are there such a thing as like inherently evil people? Mm-hmm. And this is, forget Martin, forget, I don't even want to introduce that with him.
Sure.
But in general, like, You know, or do you decide to make a wrong decision that you know is not right and stick to it? Like where you have, it's like, you know, they say a hill to die on. Like, right. Can one of those decisions come to define your personality? I think they can.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, to brush it in a broad stroke of just like evil versus good, that's, you know, a little false, right? Because, it's just too big, right? It's too big.
I hope
and there's
so.
Too much gray area in there. But the idea that you could be morally sound or morally unsound. I mean, I guess, of course, this depends on, you know, your objective version of what morals are and morality. But, you know, something that I've experienced through life that's been a great frustration to me is like, I have a really, really, really high standard for myself of how you should treat other people and what you should do, and a level of honesty that's almost crippling to myself sometimes, but it's there. And sometimes I'll come across someone who does something completely the opposite, and I do realize that they did something I am absolutely incapable of. And that exists. You know, there is a delineation. Like, it's like the evil is always there, right? It's always waiting for anybody who wants it. And some people do make a choice that it's okay to use it. And some people will never use it, you know? So, so I don't know if that's like some abject version of evil versus good, but I do think there is like a, I do think there's a, like, not a gray area with that. I do think there's a pretty strong line.
Sure.
What do you think?
Well, I think, Okay. I also think that there is like people who are willing to do something bad. Does that make them bad people? I certainly did a lot of bad things when I was addicted to drugs.
Sure.
You know? Like I stole money.
Right.
I lied all the time. I lied about where I was, where I was going, what I was doing, who I was with constantly.
Yeah.
I made promises that I didn't keep.
Right.
I skimped on work that I was supposed to be doing. I, you know, all that kind of stuff, like objectively bad things. And being in an anonymous program that, you know, encourages people to reform and, you know, start again and sort of like change their lives. I see a lot of people who've done a lot of really, really bad things.
Sure.
And have managed to turn around where I'm like, I think this person's a good person. And I think they've redeemed, I mean, it's not up to me whether they've redeemed themselves, you know what I mean? Like, but I do think that I will see them as they are now and knowing that they've done evil things, be like, I like this guy and I think he's a good guy. And I think he has really strong principles and beliefs. And at this point, there's nothing worth breaking that for because he's like regained some humanity. So that kind of perspective, it definitely complicates things for me.
Right.
You know,
because then that, you know, because if you have that perspective, then you need to leave the path to redemption open for everyone, right?
For everyone.
Everyone.
Yeah.
And that's a hard pill
to swallow.
But
I also think that when you take this past the personal, right?
Yeah.
And you put it into the realm of the social sphere, the political arena, and kind of like society at large, there are these two kind of factions almost. There's like a faction that's like, cancel them because they're wrong and they've done something wrong.
Yeah.
And then there's a faction that maybe says like, you shouldn't cancel anyone, free speech, yada, yada, whatever,
right.
whatever.
Right.
And I do think that like, that you can use the redemption narrative to actually not to make it so that doing bad things isn't even bad. You know what
How
I mean?
So?
Like, oh, sure. Well, so it's like, oh, you want to cancel him for this. You know, that's just like you. It's like, well, you know, rape is wrong.
Yeah. Right.
And like, there should be consequence for X, Y, and
Z. Like, slow down here. I'm not wrong for canceling this person for rape. The rape is wrong.
Right.
Yeah.
And like, there is no, oh, everybody, more, you know, moral relativity,
everybody's bad.
If you say they're bad, it's like, no, there are things that we should say, no, this is not acceptable. And you know what? People shouldn't be getting away with this.
Yes.
This is like become a real problem. And then on the other side of things, there's also like, if somebody goes to jail for 20 years, comes out and tries to make good on a debt to society, like, do we support them? Do we get them their rights back? Do we get them the ability to vote back? Do we help them find jobs? Do we help them find housing? Like, I am a big believer that yes, we do. But it's like so complicated when you bring it into the social and political realm, because it's almost a, in some ways, it's a symbolic fight about what you believe in and which side you're on.
Right.
And you know, that makes things way more complicated.
When,
I know I took us really, like, talk about going off track. I took us way down one road, but.
Oh, Jeff, that's the point, my friend. Listen, we've known each other. You know, I'm not interested in, like, how did you come up with the guitar part for, you know what I mean? Like, you know, we're not fucking going there, man.
Good versus evil. That's a good, you know.
Yeah. Well, road. But in reality, I mean, it's, you know, we're in such a, you know, like in the last couple of years, I've seen people canceled who I went, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
That's awful. Yeah. Bye. You know what I mean?
Yeah, man.
See you
what
later.
The hell?
Like,
yeah.
Cool. Like, no interest. You're gone. You're out of my narrative. But then there's other people I've been, you know, like, I don't know if this person actually owned up to it and I believed it and wanted to move on with life, then maybe I would. And then, but then there's a whole other thing you talk about with social and the media that makes it sad is, like, take an issue like Kobe Bryant, mm-hmm. you know, he died in this sudden way with, you know, and I'm a Kobe guy, like, I'm not going to go crazy here.
Kobe,
you know, totally changed the narrative for a lot of things. But one of the fascinating things about his death and watching it play out was the trial in which he's admitted that he sexually assaulted a woman and paid off. And the reason you don't know the exact details is because they settled it. And because clearly mm-hmm. something happened, he was with his wife when it happened. And the fact that Kobe went out and won a championship the year after for a city that loved him, then he never played for another city. And then years after just kept doing different things and randomly happened to have four daughters, you know, and became this, like, amazing daughter dad and everything like that. He passed away and literally no one even fucking mentioned it. You know what I mean? Like, the fact that this happened, and I'm not trying to drag Kobe Bryant through the mud. That's not the point of this illustration. It's more that I could easily see another 10 basketball players who weren't nearly as successful or didn't, you know, shape their narrative so cleverly when they were out of the NBA, that's all people would talk about. And no matter what they did on the court, the only thing that people would talk about is the fact that this happened to you in Denver. So it was like a really fascinating thing to watch about, you know, what people decide to be furious about and why. And sometimes it really does feel self-serving. You know, it's like, I want to be furious when it's somebody I want to be furious against. But if it's one of my people, you know, I'll let them slide.
Right. And the thing is, too, is like, yeah, it's like, you're either going to, one of the things that I've really struggled with recently now that I've, like, really tried to start making amends for, like, my past wrongs and I've really tried to, you know, live by a set of principles that are more important to me than what comes from, like, my work and, you know, money and, you know, the results basically can no longer be as important to me as, like, the sort of standards that I live my life by, like, ethically, you know, like, I have to do these things. That's more important than whether or not things work out the way I want them to, is, like, something that I've tried to really learn to accept. But one of the things that I find myself struggling with all the time is there are things that to not do them seems like an ethical wrong, right? Mm-hmm. Like, to not stand up against evil in the world, to not, you know, to basically, like, call it to not punch a Nazi, right?
That
is an ethical evil, right?
Yeah.
But I'm also aware that in my life, I've been a drug addict who didn't know what the fuck he was talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I have to at least open the door to self-doubt, you know, far enough to say, like, am I always going to know the right guy to punch? If there's some doubt, should I maybe not punch the guy?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You know, but then at what point am I just being complacent and lazy and not doing the work that I should be doing? Is something that's something that I, that degree to which I do or do not stand up for what I think is right, and whether or whether or not I judge myself as somebody who knows the difference at this point.
That's why revolution's for the young, right? Because they don't even think about it.
You don't question it. Yeah.
You don't think. You're just, they don't have the A and B and C yet. It's just like, yeah, fucking punch this guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which they might be right. And, you know, like we might have just.
They might be.
You know, it's like the people who become public school teachers with the best intentions, you know?
Yeah.
Regardless, if you go through 15, 20 years of that.
That's what I want it to be.
You know?
Yeah.
I watched it through my family. You know, my brother is a high school English teacher. And, you know, like. Watching him year after year he has to motivate himself. You know what I mean? The system he's in certainly isn't going to do it.
Yeah. Well, we were still at school when we were still playing shows together before I had been like, I'm definitely going to be a musician for the rest of my life. You know, when I was just like, this is fun to be in a band. I was doing Teach for America.
Mm.
And man, that gave me pause. Just that experience of doing Teach for America was like, whoa, I don't know if I can be cut out to like be a fatalist, you know, to be like, you're stuck here, kid. And this system sucks and you're not going to change it. So fucking get used to it. It's like, whoa.
Yeah. That's a tough thing to go through. Yeah. It's another story. We'll talk about that in private. So, okay. So we've been serious for a good, like 15 minutes now.
Oh my gosh. So, too long.
Yeah. Ugh. Back to my Anchorman manuscript.
Please.
So we had mystery question. Now we have mystery friend.
Who did you piss on? Who did you offend? Were you late to the game? Did you show up at the end? Put on your thinking caps. It's your mystery friend.
Okay. Ooh. Now, do you know the point of this game?
No.
So I hit up one of your old friends or new friend. I don't want to give anything away.
Okay.
And I got a couple stories about something that happened. I'd like you to elaborate on the story and then guess which mystery friend told me. Are you ready?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's fun. But,
I'm filled with fear.
But no. Listen, I've run into some issues lately of getting some pretty... I've gotten some stories from the past that some people don't want to unearth. So I've learned in the process of mystery friend not to get too into the underbelly.
Too illegal. Here, okay? Yeah. Nothing illegal.
Nothing illegal. Right. So, all right. So the first one I heard was, and I remember this about you. You're a bit of a germaphobe.
Okay.
And you're recording an album and you're on the floor eating. And someone walked by and stuck their hand in your food and ate it.
Yeah.
And when you seemed a little freaked out and put your sandwich down, they rubbed your sandwich on a carpet and ate it?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
And so then licked the rest of it. Yeah.
To prove what? That bacteria is good?
Like, bacteria is good. Yeah, don't worry about it. See, look at this.
Yikes. So what happened? Where was this, first off?
We were at Big Blue Meanie Studio.
Okay.
We were recording maybe War All the Time.
Okay.
Maybe not. I'm not sure.
Full Collapse is what I was told.
Okay. Well, that's possible. Yeah, that's possible. I mean, the only reason I said War All the Time is because we spent 20 days making Full Collapse and like 8.5 months making War All the Time.
Right.
So like, you know, most stories I figure probably happened during that. But no, that actually makes more sense. Cause I think I was like still driving, for what it's worth.
Okay.
Still had a license. So I was like picking up a salad at the same place every day, like a salad, I think it was actually a salmon salad, and he rubbed the salmon on the carpet. Ugh. And I was like, oh man. But it was the studio owner and the guy who mixed those records. And he was like a real overbearing guy. I have love and respect for him, and I think he's great. And before I was in the band, when I was like 16, I started interning there in the studio, and I learned lot. Like, I learned a lot there. And I took care of his four golden retrievers for years. And like, I have such a like fondness for that time. But yeah, it made me crazy, crazy that. And I was really hungry. And also like, there's nothing to eat around the studio at the time. So it was kind of like, guess what? You don't have lunch anymore.
Yeah. Big Blue is not exactly like, you're not looking at a, that's a bit of a barren food area up there. So what was your reaction? Were you pissed, confrontational, or did you just kind of sigh and deal with it?
That's a good question. I think if it was full collapse, I think I probably sighed and dealt with it because it was like, they were doing us such a huge favor of doing the record cheap.
Mm.
And like, I was kind of like, and I had also worked for him for so long that I was used to getting beat up by like, you know, when people talk about like the kids these days,
right,
you know, have it so easy expecting to be, expecting to be coddled with like respect for your humanity. I'm like, well, they deserve humanity, but also like, yeah, I remember working 90 hours a week and being like, shit on,
yeah,
constantly,
just getting ripped,
you know,
by these people.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess with four golden retrievers, you really can't be too stressed about bacteria. You know what I mean?
Like, that's a good point, but that didn't bother me. Like, they would like lick the inside of my mouth all the time, and I'd be like, "You're a good dog," you know.
Yeah.
But like a human with their finger touching my food was like, that's the most disgusting thing
I can understand.
I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, it's a strange delineation. I mean, I'm a little more like this guy, you know, I'll eat food off the floor that's been there for a couple minutes or something. We've been through this. But I mean, I guess I appreciate people like that. 'Cause I'm like, oh wow. All the way back then you were into, you know, healthy gut flora, you know?
Right. No, I mean, yeah, he's like an ox.
Yeah,
this guy,
it's revolutionary.
You know? Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So that was one fun one. I got two for this.
So
time.
Who?
I'm not,
okay.
We're not telling.
Am I supposed to guess? No? Okay.
I think you're definitely going to get it after the next one. So maybe field one guess right now.
Joe Padula?
No. Okay. Moving on.
Ooh,
so
okay.
The next story I heard, you're close though. So I heard back in the day you would like notoriously run out of gas all the time.
Oh, I almost told a story about this earlier.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
So I heard
Space Cowboy, they used to
call
me. Yeah.
Yes. I heard that you overheard a conversation calling you Space Cowboy. And then I heard about a cross country trip to meet the Murder City Devils where you ran out of gas. Well, what was your deal?
Yeah. I would do it a lot.
I know.
I don't know. This is probably bad to say. I would sort of like black out while driving and just sort of like lose myself and come to.
Mm.
And usually something would have to change to make me come to. Like, so like the suddenly the gas pedal not working would be one of the things
oh
that would
gosh.
Make me come to. Did this person tell you about the field of corn one?
No.
So I did run out of gas with us in, I guess it was Iowa.
Oh, perfect.
And like 60 miles away from like the nearest like rest stop. And so I pulled off at the exit hoping that I would get to the exit, but I coasted into like a field of corn and it was like maybe 5 a.m.
Oh
or 4:30 a.m. And I also had this really nice like Leica camera that somebody had given me.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were stuck with no gas in the middle of a cornfield in Iowa. So I just thought, you know, it's going to get pretty out soon. I went out into the field and started taking pictures. And when my band woke up wondering what the fuck was going on, I just took pictures of them getting out of the van and realizing that I had stranded us in a cornfield with no gas.
So you were taking it artistic before you even began to think about gas.
Right. And also like, imagine my band's reaction, one, to getting stranded in Iowa with no gas, yeah, but also like, Jeff is so unconcerned. He's taking a picture of my tired reaction to being like, what the fuck? They were not psyched.
No. I heard these stories and I'm like, geez, I would be so fucking pissed
yeah.
if I was on those tours.
Yeah.
All right. So, I mean,
Tucker came with me real quick. Tucker came with me to go find a gas station was the idea, even though we were so far, like
right.
so far.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we did one cross street. We had were walking for maybe a mile and a half and there was finally a cross street. And I was like, oh, houses. And by the time we had walked like 20 or 30 paces down the cross street, like a the neighborhood dogs, all the stray dogs had started following us, like 10 feet behind us, growling.
Get the fuck out of here. Really?
Yeah. And he was like, oh man, I don't know. I don't think this is good. I think this is bad. They're getting up like the courage to get closer and snap at us instead. Yeah. Like, yeah.
How did that pan out? Did you run?
Eventually somebody came, and we were like, where's the closest gas station? He was like, no, like 30 miles. What are you talking about? Like, no, there's no gas station. And so I think finally somebody gave one of us a ride and a ride back, and we gave them money.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's intense.
With one of those little red.
I mean, yeah. Well, I'm imagining like, this is the beginning of like, you know, a great movie. It's like 4:30 in the morning, you know, the sun is just creeping up over the horizon.
Pre-cell phone.
There's an abandoned van in a cornfield with some sleeping guys, the space cowboy taking pictures.
Yeah.
And then you walk into town with the stray dogs. I mean, this could pan out in so many different ways. It's great.
Oh, when we saw Green Room, I don't know if you had this experience. When we saw Green Room, we were like, oh man, we were so close to that so many times.
Yeah, so many times.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Oh my God, I love it. So, all right. So now take the guess of who told
Tucker?
Me. Close. No.
Steve.
Steve. Steve Padula.
I was closer before when I said his brother.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, you almost nailed it. I was wondering. Yeah. I was like, ah, I don't know. I thought if I used Jonah as a mystery friend, you'd just be like Jonah too fast. It'd be too easy.
Yeah, right.
Because I don't know any of the other guys in United Nations or some. I figured if I went back to a deep Thursday cut, that at least you would have to guess the members of Thursday. So that was functional. Now, speaking of Steve and where you guys are from, there's a quick thing I just want to bring up. Now, it's fun. So I'm really into history. So I looked up your area, right, of where you're from, just out of curiosity to see if there's anything funky about Dumont or, you know, where you're from. There's not, by the way.
Not
a very rich history, but
there's a couple things though.
Okay. Well, lay it on me after this. So the one thing I want to talk to you about is, have you ever heard of burrowitis?
What?
Okay. So this is also burrow fever, or burrow mania was the creation in the 1890s by referendum of large numbers of small boroughs in New Jersey and Bergen County. So there's a whole reason why this was done. It was like township and development of commuter suburbs, but it was really this one like little law that somebody acted that anybody with over like, you know, 1,000 square yards and like, you know, a mail station or something was allowed to call itself its own borough. And I'm looking at this and I'm like, holy shit. That's the reason when you go up into Bergen County, you're driving for about 2.5 minutes and you're in a new fucking town.
Yeah. Well, Dumont is 1 square mile.
Yeah. They're always tiny. Yeah. And then Steve was telling me where he moved. I'm like, this makes sense. What's up with these little things? And it was a phenomenon in the late 1800s called burrowitis. So
it was like before Beatlemania, we had burrowitis.
You had burrowitis.
Everybody's like, I'm in a burrow.
Listen, we're always the trailblazers, Jeff.
I love it. Yeah.
This is Jersey to the max.
Well, you know, Dumont, for a small town, we have a couple famous people.
Yeah, so what happened in Dumont?
Down the street, have you ever heard of the Iceman?
Like the Iceman cometh?
The Iceman killer, yeah.
Oh, yeah. From Dumont. Okay.
Dumont. He lived in Dumont.
Good.
When he was doing his killings at the rest areas and stuff like that and keeping the bodies on ice, that was Dumont.
Okay.
That was Dumont.
By where you grew up?
Very close, like down the block.
Oh,
yeah.
Good.
So that's one.
Okay.
And the other one, I think, I don't know if he lives there anymore or if he just grew up there, but Michael Graves, the second singer of the Misfits.
Yes. Right.
Yeah.
Michael Graves.
I'm not a fan per se.
Yeah.
But he is from my town.
He's in very good shape.
Is he? I bet he is.
Well, you have to be, right, to be in the Misfits. I think it's part of the deal.
Oh, I guess you do.
Yeah. You got to be buff. Yeah.
Yeah, I think he's maybe a pretty big MAGA guy these days or something. Yeah, I feel like I heard that somewhere.
I really wouldn't doubt that. That was the same prerequisite in Thursday, right? You had to be like a little yoked up. jacked.
Yeah. You had to be so swole to be a Thursday is the thing.
I loved it because like in the delineation of Thursday, Tucker was, he was like from White House. He was like the man's man in Thursday to be, you know?
Yeah.
Like
by far.
Because yeah. I remember one story about him like killing a deer that he hit with his car. And I was like, oh, that's super fucking tough, man. So,
Well, yeah, but he was vegan. So that was a big bummer for him.
I know. Yeah. He wasn't into it. I had a similar incident when I hit my first deer. But yeah, we won't get it. A little Tucker Rule appreciation, Steve Padula appreciation. Let's give him a little.
Tucker's the best, man.
A round of applause.
Yeah. Great Tucker drummer. Is the best. Great drummer. Amazing drummer.
Tucker was one of those people that I watched. I greatly respect Tucker, but I always thought it was really cool from a drummer's perspective, from like your demo to your first record to your second record.
Yeah.
You hear Tucker get so much better, you know, and really develop his style.
Crazy.
And like, and that is always just a testament to hard work and focus and like all the things you have to do to rise the tide you're in. So I always had a lot of respect for Tucker in that way, and a great performer. He's awesome on stage, man.
In the beginning, he was like learning drums to be in Thursday,
right?
You know,
yeah.
And then when you get to War All the Time, you just go, dude, what?
Yeah.
Like Kevin Lyles, we were on Island Def Jam by then. Kevin Lyles, you know, a Def Jam guy.
Mm-hmm.
When he heard the record, he said, "Is that a drum machine?"
Oh.
We were like, "No, it's a human." And he goes, "It's hard to believe that a person can do that."
Wow.
And I was like, damn, Tucker.
Yeah.
You just got like a huge compliment.
Yo, that's some juice right there.
Yeah.
Intense. You know, if only compliments like that paid for your mortgage, right?
Yeah.
Can that be part of Spotify's new profile? Like every compliment comes with 0.22 cents or something? I think.
Is it? That would be incredible.
That'd be
oh
nice.
My God.
So, all right, Jeff, we've been on for a while already.
We have, but the time melts away with you.
I know, I know. I could talk to you for hours, but I do want to see, you know, you've been on this interesting journey. As you said, you're 40 now and kind of on a new path for yourself. Where are you seeing yourself at 50? Give me like the realistic version, and then give me like the fantasy version.
Yeah. The realistic version, like I'd love to realistically figure out how to take all the work that I do. You know, I do some music supervising for TV shows. I do like interviews. I do, you know, a lot of different stuff, coaching vocalists
right.
and producing bands. I'd love to be able to learn how to make a living doing that. That's my realistic goal.
Sure.
All the amazing things that I do. And then my fantasy goal would be like, I'm like Frank Sinatra. Like,
oh.
like I've started wearing suits and now I'm just a crooner.
Love it.
You know, where people are like, oh, I didn't know he was going to be sick when he got older. Like, this is so much better. You know, like that's my
Jeff,
fantasy.
Stop it. That's not a fantasy. This could be done.
Yeah, you can do it, dude.
Oh my God. It's so easy. You're from the right area.
Oh, I got blue eyes.
You got blue eyes. You're handsome.
But you know, when they I'm going to say it was a blow to see that Scott Stapp got the gig in the movie before I did. Which is weird, you know, because he's got brown eyes, which is just makes it even weirder that he's being cast to play Sinatra.
You remind me of one of those questions that I always like to ask people to kind of sum up with what, like where their head is at, which is which would you be in the 60s Rat Pack or 70s Stones?
Oh, 60s Rat Pack. Yeah.
Yeah.
For one thing, I'm one of those, I'm not a Stones hater. Of course, I love the Stones music. But like when people are like Beatles or Stones, I'm like, that's not even like, it's not even a comparison. Like throw the Stones out the window, and keep like one Beatles record.
I got to be honest with you guys. I don't know if it's because of the difference of how we were raised or the fact that I'm a Jew or something. But the idea of hanging out with like this, I don't think that would go well for me.
What?
Which one?
Like, are you trying to tell me there's no member of the Rat Pack that wasn't anti-Semitic? Are you crazy?
There was a Jewish.
I mean, but Sammy Davis Jr.
Sammy Davis Jr. was anti-Semitic.
He was Jewish.
Wait, no, he's Jewish.
Apparently, this is what I'm saying. He did a lot of questionable things, Sammy Davis. No, that, actually, that's a really interesting story to look up. Is when Sammy Davis, I think it was Richard Nixon, went on stage with Nixon at a Republican National Convention, and that ended up being a really, really strange stain on his whole life, where he, later in life, was talking about it like you know, that he shouldn't have done it, and he was forced in a weird way. And that's what I'm saying. Rat Pack.
No, I think the Rat Pack is super questionable. You know,
Voting Rights Act didn't happen until 1965. I might not be in a fantasy scenario prior to then.
Right. No, I get it. I get it.
So, I mean, you enjoy it because you guys are white. Have fun with the fucking Rat Pack, right?
Look. There's more white people in the Stones. This is all because there's a bigger percentage of white people in the Stones. Benny.
I know. At least they were stealing black music, right? Yeah. Makes it more comfortable.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, there we go. All right. That's the perfect place to end, Jeff. I had like a, I had a bummer of a question too. But okay, Brad,
do we want to wait till we're off? Then?
Brad's been coaching me on going off on a high here. You know, he thinks that.
I like that.
Yeah, he thinks that sometimes I'm just like, oh, that was really funny. What do you think happens when you die?
Yeah. He's like, but will you ever feel love?
All right. Well, Jeff, I had so much fun talking to you, man.
I'm glad we could. It's great talking to you.
Catch up on an interview now. We don't have to talk on direct message anymore. Let's stay in touch. Yeah. All right, man. Well, thanks for doing this. Thanks for being a four-time guest of Going Off Track. Yeah. You're going to get your gold jacket at 6, all right?
I'm looking forward to 6. All right. I'm going to go steal it from Jeff Rosenstock.
All right. Thanks, Jeff. Have a good one, man.
Take care, guys. Bye-bye.
All right.
Hey, whoa.
Hey.
You have that gabagool?
Oh.
A little gabagool?
Space Cowboy reminded me. So I ran out of gas in Nebraska. What did he say? Iowa?
He said Iowa. Yeah, similar.
And it was like, same. It was, you know, I'd been driving all night, not paying attention, and everybody else was asleep in the back of the van. And I pull over and like, they didn't even all wake up. So somebody like stuck their head up and was like, what's going on?
Yeah,
like, I fucking ran out of gas. I'm walking. I get out of the van. It's like 5 o'clock. The sun is just barely cleared. You know, it's like early morning.
It sounds pretty.
I'm in Nebraska, which means I can see for like 85 miles in all directions. Right, and there's nothing. Right. There's been no signs. But I'm like, whatever, I fucked up. I ran out of gas. I get out and I start walking up this long, straight highway, you know, and I get like maybe, I don't know, like 200 feet away from the van when I hear a whoop, whoop, and I turn around. There's a fucking Nebraska state trooper pulling up behind me.
Got statey on my tail. Okay.
Like, I probably had purple hair. Like, you know, it's been like, we'd never had a good run-in. You know, as far as I come to know it, to that point there was no Midwestern cool state troopers, you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
So I wasn't psyched. He pulls up, he's like, what's going on? I'm like, ran out of gas, I'm gonna go get some gas. He's like, hop in. I'm like, So I hop in the front seat, right? He's like, it's a long ways to the next station, to the gas station. And he's like, I'll give you a ride. I'm like, oh, cool. Thanks, man.
Great, yeah.
He proceeds to fucking floor it.
Oh, really?
He punched it. Dude, it was almost 100 miles an hour, which like...
Oh, that's awesome.
Let's face it. It was a perfectly straight road. Yeah. 5:30 in the morning. There's no traffic. Like, I wasn't afraid for my life, but I was like, holy shit.
Dude, that's fun as fuck.
He tried to talk music, but he was like, I listen to country music. I don't really know anything about punk rock.
And yeah.
Drove me to the fucking station, waited while I got a can and filled it, and drove me back to the fucking car at 100 miles an hour.
He did 100 each way?
Yeah.
Oh, I love this.
It was fucking insane. But
how cool.
So props to Nebraska State Police because...
Yeah, good on that.
Yeah.
Man, I heard that story, and the first thing that just came to mind was like, oh my God, I would fucking kill that person. I would, like that was the person I was in the band. You know what I mean? I would have popped my head and been like, you fucking kidding me? You know, like, this is real. Maybe the first time, you know, you can make a mistake, right?
You're allowed at least one of those.
If it happens once, you go like, oh, for real? Ran out of gas? All right, let's try to figure it out. But the second time, oh man, I'd lose my shit.
Yeah.
I think a person could have gotten kicked out of my band
Dude, the Midwest and the Far West, it's a long ways between stations and stuff.
Yeah, but you know that. If you see a gas station, you're under half a tank, you fucking fill it up.
Right.
This is road rules number one, man.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't take long to figure that part out.
You're right.
Yeah. I don't know. I did it once. Okay. And it's actually funny because this ties in the Thursday. I was doing a tour with a band called We're All Broken, who Steve from Thursday, his brother Joe is the drummer in We're All Broken, also a good friend, Joe Padula.
Right.
And I was touring with those guys and I was doing that stretch of 95. You know, going from like DC back up to Jersey.
Ugh, the worst.
And anybody who's done that knows you have your two stops on 95 in Maryland. You either have Maryland House or Chesapeake House.
Right.
Those are your two options. Now, I believe it was Chesapeake House that had a Sbarro's.
Okay.
And I was very into the spinach stuff slice. I thought it was really good. And I just had this hankering for Sbarro's. And I passed the Maryland House to try to make it to Sbarro's and realized it was a mistake. And I putted that van, I putted it into the Chesapeake House just to the gas station to get my Sbarro's. So of course, classic fat boy move. I wasn't being a space cowboy. I knew exactly how much gas we had. I just really wanted my stuff slice. That's the only time I've even come close to running out of gas. So I'm like a nut job with that stuff.
Yeah.
But that's terrifying. Oh, I just black out while I'm driving until the gas pedal doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, I kind of get it though. You get into a zone. It's not, I don't think it's unsafe. I think you can make, you know, you can react, but also dude, those states, man, it's straight as an arrow.
Yeah, I know. I've done it. I've done it a lot and I've always had gas and never fell asleep. Listen, this is why Jeff is a true artist and I'm a drummer. You know, drummers fill up at a quarter tank. True artists zone out until the gas pedal gives out. Maybe that's the delineation here. But yeah, I don't know. That was a really fun interview. I felt like I pulled off not talking about emo once. I didn't talk about My Chemical Romance once. I tried to give Jeff a little bit of a different interview. You know, everyone's always asking him the same
shit. Going off track. That's what it is.
But we've known each other a long time And honestly, I saw him in some pretty dire spots in his time where like his life could have taken some negative turns. And the fact that he's a few years sober and happy and talking the way he's talking and has his life nice and figured out like this, it's refreshing and it's nice to see. You know, I'm really happy for him, honestly.
Oh, yeah. Check in with Jeff Rickley, at Jeff Rickley, Instagram, Twitter, at Thursday Band, both of those. Check in with us at Going Off Track, patreon.com/goingofftrack, where you can give us money and we'll try to give you some stuff back that you aren't hearing here right now.
Well, Brad, before you ask for money, tell the people what they get for the money.
Well, we've got some, I've started to come up with sort of a theme, that I call like after the tape stop rolling.
Oh, really? We have a new segment on Patreon?
I'm kind of calling it that.
Okay. I like this.
Which is, it's kind of true because we record and everybody into this one. I'm not going to get into the tech of it, but I have like kind of a safety backup that I keep rolling after we stop recording. And sometimes the conversation doesn't stop. So that gets posted when it's appropriate.
When it's appropriate, yeah.
So there's stuff like that. We've got some full bonus episodes. I actually may post another vintage. We've got a vintage episode up there with Jonah and Steven hosting that was never made public.
Oh, really? Cool.
Yeah, and there's a part two to it that I may put up in the next week or two. We are trying to schedule some like interaction with our patrons.
Yeah.
Which I'm still trying to nail down, but that would be
group
in the
chat.
Form of a group chat.
Yeah.
It's maybe a holiday fun group chat. Who knows?
Oh, I love it. Let's set it up. Let's do one before New Year's.
Okay. I'll try to make it happen.
Group chat with the Patreons before New Year's.
But yeah, thanks. We love our patrons. They're very generous to us. And there's also, we've got a Venmo account. It's at Off Track. And if you want to just throw us a buck or two, you can give us a tip there. We've got a few recently that we're grateful for. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
And you can leave us a good a body or otherwise review on iTunes, which is also always nice.
Oh, yeah. Sexual in nature, please. You know, I felt bad about the Rat Pack. So I found a quote by Sammy Davis Jr., which says, "I have to be a star like another man has to breathe." Imagine if people said shit like that these days.
Wow.
That's what I'm going to kick off every episode with now.
I'm a big Sammy fan. I'll give him tons of leeway.
No, he's cool. I honestly don't know dick about that stuff. I just basically blanketly look at anything before like 1970 is terrible.
Well, it was, yeah.
If Steely Dan wasn't around, I'm not interested. All right, let's get out of here.
All right, see you next week.
Right, thanks, everyone. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.